What I would like to do is explain something which may strike you from the title as frivolous or superfluous or simply entertaining, and some of you know I like to laugh, and there is humor, I think, in just about every situation, but something which I think is really very important and a part of this whole celebration of the cult of success in America, which has very significant, although a different kind of religious overtones than that which Walt was talking about. And I was very impressed with the fact that he was using metaphors from the world of sports, the killer instinct and all the rest of these things, because this is in a very real way what I want to be talking about today. And I would like to sort of suggest a topic or a parable for you to think about before we go through this material, and then raise at the end of the hour, because it may or may not, I don't know, it just happened the other day, but it may or may not put together some of the things that I'm trying to say. If you've been following baseball, you've been following the vicissitudes of Billy Martin. And the last that I read about Billy Martin is now that he's been rehired. And that he will take over again as manager of the Yankees in the spring of 1980. Apparently he has to do some penance or have some earthly form of purgatory, since he's Catholic himself, to live in until that time. But then cynics would say, and then I don't want to get into the cynic thing like Walt was saying, we shouldn't get into the cynic thing. $90,000 a year in purgatory isn't all that bad, but anyway. Billy Martin represents something really very important. We take this very seriously in our lives, because there is a kind, I think, of a theme of the prodigal son in Billy Martin that I think, you know, I'd like to just sort of throw out now, and then when we have time towards the end to come back to that. And two books I'd like to recommend. The one I'm going to draw from very heavily. Some of you know Michael Novak, who, like Martin Marty, has his own Book of the Month Club, and writes what's the word? Omnivorously, I guess that's the word for it. But writes frequently, and you know, sometimes writes well, and sometimes doesn't write well. But this one is an especially good book, The Joy of Sports. And another one, and I don't think I can be accused of plugging anybody for politics in New Jersey, and that is Bill Bradley's book, Run for Your Life, which I recommend very highly, because Bill Bradley was one of the great players in the great teams for the Knicks, the New York Knickerbockers, and wrote an autobiography called Run for Your Life, which is not just a story about what athletes do, you know, waiting for planes, and in the hotel corridors at 2 o'clock in the morning, and all the other sort of exposés that sell well and kind of cheapen sports. But it's a very serious attempt to explain some of the things that Novak is talking about here today, because you can always find people, you know, who make money on the exposé kinds of things, and if you've been following Doonesbury lately with the wonderful spoof he's doing on the Washington Redskins. And all the rest, I think you see what I'm getting at. Now, just a couple of basic introductions on this particular topic. What we're going to be talking about is not the kind of theology that Walt was talking about, but the kind of theology which is natural theology, not a revealed theology. There is no given written text, so to speak, for the kind of religion that I'm talking about today. But it's the kind of religion that emerges out of everyday experiences, out of our natural instincts, out of that which in our individual and our common lives we feel and hope and sometimes know to be true. And it is not, I am not saying, and Novak repeats this over and over again, that organized sports is a paradigm or an explanation or a metaphor really for Christianity or for Judaism or anything else like that. But it is something which arises out of our daily life, in which we try, in what he calls liturgical forms, to find meaning, to celebrate those elements in our lives which give meaning and direction to it, which don't have to rely, you see, on what we would call a revealed religion, such as Christianity would be a revealed religion, or Judaism or some of the others would be a revealed religion at all. And what Novak says, uses as his source here is that in our particular society, what has happened with the organization of sports is that it has become more than entertainment. And if it's only entertainment for you, fine. No quarrel with that. But what he's trying to show is that it can be more than entertainment. It can be more than relaxation. It can be more than, I'll give you a perfect example of this, can be more than some of the things that it has been for me. I was having some psychosomatic things about illness, and the counselor asked me, now, if you left this office right now, what would you like to do right now more than anything else? Well, this particular moment, if you left the place where I was, what would you like to do? And it came back to me right away, I'd like to go out and see the Vikings kick the hell out of somebody. And that was true. We had lost 4 Super Bowls, and I'm ready to win, you know. And this is Fran's last year, and by golly. Anyway, the point was that sports in that particular sense was, and she saw it and picked it up right away, as an outlet for my aggression and for hostility and everything else, and encourage that sort of thing. And if you see sports in that kind of sense as a psychological release as well as being entertainment, fine. But Novak argues that it's really much more than that. And I think I'll read here so we can get a basic understanding of precisely what he's saying. The basic reality of all human life is play. Games, sport. These are the realities from which the basic metaphor for all that is important in the rest of life are drawn. Work, politics, and history are the illusory, misleading, false world. Being, beauty, truth, excellence, transcendence. These words, grown in the soil of play, wither in the sand of work. Art, prayer, worship, love, civilization, these thrive in the field of play. Play belongs to the kingdom of ends, work to the kingdom of means. Barbarians play in order to work. The civilized work in order to play. And he goes on with other descriptions, but I'd rather go through some of this material, and maybe we can come back to some of that. Now, why is this the case? Why is sports more than entertainment? Why is it something more than simply a way in which you find an outlet for your aggressions? And in what particular sense is it a liturgical or religious expression of our deepest natural kinds of instincts? And I'll just go through his reasons, and anytime anybody wants to comment or criticize or evaluate, I'd be delighted for this. First of all, he argues for many people, this is organized sports, and he talks primarily about football, basketball, and baseball. And before we get started, I want to get in one metaphor, because sometimes if I get carried away, I forget these things. And he has a wonderful little description. He says, baseball is like chamber music. It's orderly, precise, neat, predictable. You know what's going to happen. It's measurable. It's all very, it's like a chess game in which it's all sort of together. Football, he says, it's like a Wagner opera. It's full of Sturm und Drang and conflict and passion and all the violence and the final victory at the end with the goddesses riding off, you know, up to Valhalla, you know, being carried off on the coach being carried off on like this. And basketball is like jazz. It's improvised, it's solo, it's each person doing its own things, it's hot dog, it's showing off, it's getting each person, first the trumpet takes it to the first riff through, and then the clarinet, and then the trombone, you know, like Dixieland, and each person doing its own thing. And if you perfect example of this, if you follow this, would be the Philadelphia 76ers, in which they have, you know, they really have 5 teams, any one of which men is good enough to play all by himself and beat most of the other teams. But it's all improvisational with this. And there's no such thing as teamwork. The man who shoots is the man who gets the ball as soon as you cross the 10-second line with this. And that's probably why the Philadelphia 76ers, you know, never won, and why 2 years ago the Portland team did win, because they didn't have much talent except for Walton, yet they had, you know, magnificent teamwork, and it all came together. All right, now, why, in what sense is our organized sports a form of liturgical expression of our deepest religious instincts? He says, first of all, sports are really a ritualistic initiation into life for the participants themselves. Participation in sports tells them what the boundaries of life are, what the opportunities of life are, what the pains and the penalties are going to be for them to expect, the rewards that they might receive, the rewards that they might that might come their way. It is a metaphor really for life itself, and as Paul himself said, you know, that life, the race is to the strongest, recognizing this sort of thing. Furthermore, it's religious in the sense that sports offer fulfillment for some of our, as I've suggested, some of our deepest needs. I'll just go through the list and then I'll elaborate on this. We need heroes. We need people larger than life. We need superhuman people. And oftentimes you hear this about various people who excel in sports, and I want to develop on that. We need dramatic events. We need something to get out of ourselves beyond the daily ordinary routine of life. Just the ordinary everyday life is pretty dull and drab. But you start preparing days, weeks, sometimes months in advance. A perfect example in my particular case would be when the U.S. Open in golf was at in the suburb of Minneapolis. And it was more fun for my son and I to plan what we were going to do, the anticipation, and where we were only going to be there for one day. And so we got the map of Hazeltine Golf Course, and where would we sit, where would be the best place, you know, where we could see everybody. But it was the anticipation that some exciting thing was going to happen to us. Some event was going to happen, and we could do it, and we could plan it together. And, you know, we did it, and we still talk back on the great shot that Tony Lima made on the 17th hole, a superhuman event that lifted us above ourselves. Nobody thought Tony could hit over that tree, you know, and get that close to birdie the 17th hole, but he did it. Which got us out of ourselves and told us that there was hope for even duffers like us, as I told you yesterday about my golf game with this. And it gives us a sense of getting out of ourselves, of elevating the ordinary into the superhuman, of heroes. It celebrates those events which, in a very real sense, give us a sense that the world is a place in which there is room and there is opportunity, there is challenge for this kind of expression. Yeah, this kind of expression really of the human spirit itself. But sports, in a very real sense, are not a complete metaphor for life, because they are also, with a few exceptions, but very few exceptions, and the ones I'm talking about, they are also clearly defined by precise rules, by defined areas of space. There is a geometric precision to them. You find this especially, of course, in baseball, and why it's 90 feet exactly. And one of the exciting things, if you like baseball, is how close, you know, on the ground ball to the shortstop it comes, because it's almost geometrically predictable how close the play is always going to be, unless you've got, you know, somebody like my old friend Earl Batty, running. He was the only one I ever saw. He was with the Twins when they went to the World Series. He hit a solid single to right field and he was thrown out at first base. It takes something to be able to do that. But the excuse is that, and I think it's true that something happens to catchers' legs with their muscles when they have to squat all the time, and catchers are always slow, and so on. So what we can do in sports then is to celebrate these needs, the excitement, the need for heroes, for getting out of ourselves and all these other things, but we can do so in a safe way. We can do so because we know that they are only games, that they are only sport, that they aren't, you know, actual life itself, but they are expressions of it for us. And that we know eventually the game will be over, and that therefore what we have participated in, you see, is entertainment, if you like, or an outlet for aggression, if you like, but we have also participated in a ritualistic expression of those natural elements, you see, not revealed, but those natural elements in our lives which we feel very deeply about and which we want to cultivate and which we want to protect and we want to, you know, in which we want to advance. Now, let me break that down into a couple of specifics here, and I would like some of your participation, if you like, in this. I think one of the attractions of sport is the way in which we can identify ourselves with certain participants, and that we can, it's like identifying yourself with a certain character in a novel or in a movie, that I'm the only one who agrees with my identification with Robert Redford. Nobody else in our family seems to think that's quite the right one. It comes down more to, you know, old chubby checkers or something, but anyway. My particular favorite is Bud Grant, the coach of the Vikings. Cool, you know, under control, the master, no matter what the situation is. With this, if I had my druthers, I would be a Bud Grant, because he's larger than life. He's superhuman. He really does, after a game, enjoy more than anything else going out and having an ice cream sundae. That is the way in which he has his release for this sort of thing. And I'm not a Hank Stram who can wear a red vest because he knows he's on, you know, on color television and strut back and forth and be sure that the camera, you know, is on him all the time with this, because that doesn't appeal to me. But we identify with sports because these athletes are the kinds of people who get us out of ourselves, and who, because they are so superb in what they do, tell us that maybe we can't do this, but we can come close to them. The best example of this, you're going to hear my particular favorite here, is I think the greatest professional basketball team of all time, and that would be the New York Knicks of 1970, in which there were five different distinct personalities. The attraction of sports, you see, is that you can identify yourself with one of these kinds, and the advantage of basketball that it has over, let's say, football, where you're helmeted and, you know, you're clothed, you can't see the people, if you're at the game and all that. The advantage in basketball is that you can see so much of them. I mean, you know, skin and all. with this. And in the Knicks, they had Bill Bradley, and I'm a teacher, and I admire the life of the mind, and Bill Bradley was a Rhodes Scholar. And to me, anybody who was a Rhodes Scholar obviously had something going for him. And he was known as one of the most intelligent players, obviously, the best man without the ball and that's ever played the game, according to some of the things. And so I identified with him. Or if you like the big, earnest, but sometimes clumsy, or the man who showed up at the time, or, you know, showed up all the time, you could identify with Dave DeBuscher. Not polished, not slick, not smooth, but earnest, hardworking, a dedicated kind of person, and who got the results done not on the basis of skill, but on the basis simply a lot of times of courage with this. Or you could be Big Willis Reed, if you like, who's now coaching the Knicks, who played, and you had to admire because he played under tremendous pain, had severe injuries, and was always able, with a superhuman effort, to come up with this sort of thing. Or you could be Cool Walt Frazier, who seemed to be able to do what was necessary at any given time in any given situation. No matter how impossible the situation was, Walt would come up with the right play at the right time. Or you could be Hot Dog Earl Monroe, Earl the Pearl, the show-off, the one who could make impossible passes and do all these things that you say physically is impossible to do. And you could identify with these people, and somehow they lifted you out of yourself, and that you could celebrate this union, really, you see, of body and mind and spirit all at the same time in the team. And of course, it helped that they won, you know. But I'll grant you that. But at the same time, they enacted in a ritualistic way those elements and those characteristics and personality which you know, give us a feeling that it's not impossible, because they were, after all, were Homo sapiens out there. And we're also Homo sapiens, and maybe, you know, there's some hope for us with this sort of thing. And of course, what television has done to encourage participatory sports, of course, is enormously important in our lives. Tennis, I suppose, would be the best example of this. All right, what I'm trying to suggest here is that in our lives, you see, we need a sense of beauty. We need a sense of order. We need superhuman events or superhuman deeds, and therefore we tend to celebrate, especially with the professionals, those who can do it best. I think this is the magic, really, of Jack Nicklaus. If you've tried golf, you know he can make these fantastic shots, and it was nice to see him win a big one again after 3 years, because, you know, it meant that he wasn't dead, and that even when you're growing older, you can celebrate age, and the young ones, the Watsons and the Crenshaws and all the rest, aren't going to take over. There's still room somewhere out there for an older one. And of course, the perfect example of this, I've got this a little bit later, but the perfect example of the one who helped us so much, and Walt was talking about middle age, was old 16 for the Oakland Raiders, George Blanda, 46 years old, and he was still out there playing. And if Blanda can still keep playing at 46, you know, there's hope for us. Maybe not playing football, but there's hope for us to be able to, you know, to be able to do something else like this. The impossible play, or my particular, you know, from our territory, it's Fran Tarkenton. The ad libber, the man who, in spite of desperate situations with, who's the 85 from the linebacker from the Rams, breathing down his neck, somehow was able to escape, and Stu Voigt comes across the middle, and suddenly, you know, what suddenly looks like a hopeless despair kind of situation is redeemed, and Fran is able on 3rd and 9 to be able to pull it out once again. The impossible kind of play that goes with this. Or last year, I suppose, one of the greatest things in all of sports, the most hated man in baseball, Reggie Jackson, in a superhuman effort, you know, making 3 home runs in the deciding game of the World Series. In a way, it wasn't justice, but in another way, it was for him, because of what he stood for in the eyes of so many people, and yet he was able to do this. In other words, what Novak is saying here, you see, is that we are uplifted, we are inspired by the beauty of the perfectly executed play, by the ideal bunt, by the fast break, by the rally. I remember a good example of this against superhuman efforts. We were at a ball game between Boston and it was then the Los Angeles Dodgers, and it went into the 10th inning. It was Ralph Branca against Johnny Sane, right. It used to be, you know, Spawn and Sane and Hope for Rain. It used to be when Boston had its great team. And it was Jackie Robinson got on first, stole second, wild pitch got him over to third base, and it was in the 10th inning, and Pee Wee Reese laid down a perfect sacrifice bunt. There is the word sacrifice, which has various kinds of connotations for this. And the daring, the bravado, the excitement of the whole thing, getting us out of ourselves, suddenly left us with a feeling that we had seen something perfect. We had seen something that only exists really usually in the textbooks. We had seen a pitcher's battle. It was a 1-0 game, but suddenly it all happened, and it all happened according to the rule. And we didn't believe really that such things could happen, but the play was perfect, and we went away, you know, feeling in a very real sense that we had been lifted really out of ourselves, and had witnessed something that was a liturgical expression, really, here, or a ritualistic expression of some of the deepest needs and accomplishments, really, of the human spirit itself. All right. Now, what Novak suggests, really, is, and to sort of sum up and then go ahead with this, is that sports really flow into action out of our deepest natural instincts. In a very real sense, you see, he considers these, in a natural sense, to be radically religious. There is an impulse for freedom. There is a respect for ritual, for instance, that goes with this. The ritual, for instance, if you watched a track meet, of the victory lap after winning, after winning. You don't have to have, you know, the relay team, you know, hand in hand running around the track. But if it's been an especially exciting race, the four men, you know, the idea of community and cooperation, hold hands, and they run around to get, you know, to get the applause of the crowd, but also to celebrate the fact that they won. It's a ritual which is expected. The home run trot is a ritual. You don't have to go around it because the ball is out of play anyway, and you don't have to do it. But it's a ritual which celebrates the fact that you've done something which nobody can do anything about. You just have to stand there and watch the ball go, and which has happened a lot in our stadium this summer in Minneapolis. All right, on this. All right, as an example. With it. And furthermore, sports are religious in the sense that they try, in a very real sense, and I hinted at this with Bill Bradley, to find ways to integrate or to make holistic the problem of integrating the body, the mind, and the spirit all at the same time. You find in sports, for instance, the preparation of the body. You find asceticism, and the ascetic is a very strong element in many religions, of self-denial, of punishment, of training. Read, for instance, the autobiography of Frank Shorter, the great long-distance runner. And he talks about the threshold of pain and why he runs 26 miles and what happens after a certain period of time and why he puts up with pain. with this, and he gets a sense of exhilaration out of the pain that comes with it, because he knows out of the pain will come a reward for this sort of thing. My favorite example of asceticism and of the coordination of body, mind, and spirit is an old shot putter, some of you I hope will remember, Perry O'Brien, in which the way in which Perry O'Brien could do what he did was to spend about an hour ahead of time, as we call it, psyching up, in which he tried to put everything together, actually hypnotizing himself, so that he was able, in this particular sense, to get out of himself, to transcend himself, and to be able to follow very strict rules. If you know the shot put, it's very strict, very precise, orderly on the one hand, and yet it takes an enormous effort on the part of the body and the mind and the spirit, which he was trying to, you know, warm up, as I say, or psych up, to do this sort of thing. And hence, when you see the perfect play, when you see the ideal situation unfolding, you realize that it is a synthesis or a combination or a collection, you see, really, of that which we consider to be significant and important and meaningful, you know, in our own lives. Furthermore, Novak makes a very good point. He said that sports are organized in a religious way, because organized sports themselves got started way back in antiquity during great religious holidays themselves, and people at that time saw no problem in having great religious holidays which were embellished by, you know, sporting events. They seem to go together. And in that particular sense, sports also, like organized religion, sports has its rituals, sports has its vestments, sports has its moments of anticipation, of reward, of punishment. All of these fill a deep human need. Placing people, as he puts it so nicely, I think, in touch with only dimly felt or dimly understood but deeply felt instincts and impulses with this. In other words, as I've suggested, they really are more than entertainment, but they are symbols of life, of victory, really, of death and defeat with this. And they are tests, really, you see, of the human spirit, because in sports there are failures and there are rewards. Give me an example of this. I remember once on one of these inane pre-game shows, warm-up shows, which they could do without, but somehow they have them because they sell products and so on. You know, you go out and ask somebody, what's going to happen today? Well, I'm going to give it my best, you know, and that's an awfully tough team, and, you know, and all these things, and all those. But once Harmon Killebrew made a very profound statement about what it meant to be a professional, and it fits in with Novak's idea here about sort of the natural instincts as expressed in the world of sports, because obviously he was going after some kind of home run record, and he made something which, a statement which I think ties in with Novak. He said that, yes, he strikes out. Somebody asked him, what does it feel like to strike out when you have men on base? And he said, you know, yes, he struck out. Yes, at that time he failed, but he knew he would have another chance. He knew that he might fail this time, but being a professional meant that he knew there would be another opportunity. If you like, there would be grace, so to speak. There would be the chance to get up after falling flat on your face, you know, and starting over again. It wasn't just a one-time opportunity. And therefore, it was sort of a metaphor for failure and reward in life itself. In the chance that maybe in an unexpected way he would be able to redeem himself, and that's a good religious word for failures which had gone on before with this. And I think sports also are like religion in that they thrive on, and they need critics, they need doubting Thomases, they need cynics, they need people who are there mostly like sports writers, you know, to keep it honest, to keep it open. Because just as any religion needs and thrives and depends on critics, and if not, and doubters all the way through, so too sports need people. Otherwise it would get to be just a big sort of glorified celebration, you know, of what we call today jocks, just a big money-making enterprise. And hence, so long as there are critics, so long as there are those who are ready to point out, you know, error and mistake, to debunk if necessary, to deflate, I think that's a better word for it, so too sports will be the better for this, and we will be the more willing to accept this sort of thing when we don't hear just the propaganda that the front office wants us to hear, but from those who are taken up with this, but are not necessarily part of the organization, the establishment itself. There's a great battle going on whether or not sports announcers should be hired by the teams themselves, or whether or not they should be independent, because it makes a lot of difference as to the way it would come out. All right. Now, the question, of course, becomes, as Novak recognizes here, you know, why haven't we sort of thought of sports in this sense before? And Novak's argument really is I think, kind of a breakthrough as to why sports have not been seen in this more symbolic, ritualistic kind of form before. And he argues that in America it's not been seen in this sort of natural religion way before, because our education in this world is much too pragmatic, it's much too factual, it's much too quantitative. We thrive and celebrate on that which we can measure, rather than recognizing the primacy, you see, and the significance and the importance of our basic natural instincts. And in America we're afraid to allow our natural instincts, our emotions, really to show. A favorite story that Phil Hansen, some of you know, who works with alcoholics in Minneapolis, is one I'd like to pass on here. He's talking about the need sometimes for some of his patients to express themselves, to break down and really let go. And he talks about the old Norwegian farmer. He said he loved his wife so much he almost told her. I think it makes the point rather well at this time. What we have, you see, in America, because men are primarily the spectators, is a sort of situation here that Novak describes as follows. Men cannot talk or write very well, he argues here, about women, about love, or about tragedy. And we see this reflected, for instance, in the movies. Who are our great heroes? The cool ones, the Humphrey Bogarts, the Newmans, the Henry Fondas, the Marlon Brandos, the Dustin Hoffmans. We see these people, and all of these are, as we would call it today, in today's jargon, laid back, or cool, or restrained, rather than being, or there are a couple exceptions to this, rather than being, for instance, the Jack Nicholsons, and if you saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you see the opposite of this, or the Gene Hackmans, for instance, all the way through. So what he means by this idea about restraint here is that sports fills a very real need. Sport fills the need of the release of very deep feelings in acts, you see, and in deeds rather than in words. Being unable to express these in words, we find in the ritualistic expressions of the emotions take place on the field, this opportunity. He goes so far as to say that sports, in a very real sense, help to civilize us. He said that sports are the most universal mass art form because they appeal, and we saw the World Cup thing and the millions and millions of people who are following of soccer follow this because they find in this ritualistic expression ways to express emotions and feelings which they wouldn't be able to do, or like the Norwegian farmer, are unable to do in direct open kinds of ways. With this, all right. In summary, really here, then I suppose you could say that there is a direct connection between a natural religion and sports in these particular elements. And I'll just sum up on this sort of thing. A religion is organized and it is structured. It needs ceremonies. It needs vestments. It needs customs. It needs traditions. It needs formalized actions, as I've talked about before. It needs moments of silence. It needs a situation where right is rewarded. Remember always the feeling we were robbed, where the referee was paid or something else like this, and so on. And therefore, under these conditions, we want to see in something besides organized religion the same kinds of natural instincts, expressed: organization, ceremony, vestments, customs, tradition, formalized actions. And we find this done so very, very well in sports. Furthermore, he makes another good point here, Sports are like religion because so much of a religious life is based simply on faith. The unpredictable, the unknown, if you like, the spontaneous, that which can happen without any, you know, clear warning or prediction ahead of time. It's based on chance, on danger. We make plans, we look ahead, we lay out careful, you know, blueprints and everything else, and suddenly, if you want to call it fate or luck or fortuitous circumstance, whatever it is, comes in and spoils everything. Somebody misses a 6-inch putt, which they make, you know, 99 times out of 100, and loses the U.S. Open because of this sort of thing. And we recognize that because it's happened to us in our own life, and we respond to that, and we can sympathize with this sort of thing on this. Or the perfect golf shot can be spoiled by a chance wind that comes along, and this is especially true in the British Open, where they play right along the coastline, and all this takes place at this sort of thing. And suddenly that is a metaphor really for the element really of fate or chance or surprise or the unknown or the unexpected in our life that comes through, I think, so well. Or the place for the underdog, somebody that nobody's heard about before. Andy Bean, for instance, coming along and suddenly challenging the great and the mighty and the powerful, which is something we like because we get tired of the same three or four people, you know, being at the top of the leaderboard all the way through on this. And then hence, besides the first part about religion and sports needing both organization and structure, also both need the element of fate or of chance. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, how does the rise of women's athletics in your opinion kind of feed into this? Question.
Yeah, he's got a long chapter on this, and I would recommend on that. He's talking about sports in general, and since, as far as, somebody correct me on this, Joanne isn't here, but there are no women's sports as such that only women do. Isn't that right? Is there a sport that I've missed that only women do? I think the only sports I know are what both men and women do. There are some sports that women don't do. What? It tends to be women, right? But it can be men. I remember when we were in Singapore, field hockey was a very big thing for men. Yeah, that's Singapore. That's not America with this sort of thing. Yeah, he has a chapter on that, and he's very enthused about the new emphasis that's coming here, and the breaking down of the stereotypes that women athletes are, you know, somewhat unusual and psychologically misfits or something else like that. But he's looking at it in a much broader terms of cultural anthropology so on. And he argues a third point here, that religion is meaningful for us because it interprets the great crises in life, the crisis of aging, the crisis of dying. And if some of you have seen the play, for instance, and the movie, I should say, of the retirement speech of Lou Gehrig, this fantastically moving expression of when the Iron Man himself, who played in over 2001 games or something else like this, makes his farewell speech. Fate stepped in, he got some rare muscular disease and all the rest, and at the end, yet in spite of this, in fact, the fact that fate, I mean, that seemed cruel to him, he had no quarrel with it. He had no argument with the fact that he was going to die soon, because baseball had been good to him, and through courage, persistence, Walt was talking about courage here before, and all these things, he had gotten much more out of life than he had ever dreamed, coming from a poor kind of background. And the ritualistic expression of Lou Gehrig retiring, and then as it did so well, it was Gary Cooper, wasn't it, in the movie, who portrayed it, walking off the stadium, and then the shadow from Yankee Stadium, you know, slowly falling over him. The director of the movie had that beautifully done. That he was now moving into the shadows of life, in other words, he was dying, was a very moving, in this particular sense, ritualistic expression, you see, of a very deep, human need with this sort of thing. Furthermore, just three or four more things here. Religion consecrates certain hours and certain days with this. If any of you have tried to have your annual meeting, like as we did, the annual meeting at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Northfield was always the third Sunday in November. Guess what is on the third Sunday in November? It's Super Bowl, whatever Roman numeral we are now. And we had a terrible battle, a terrible battle over whether or not to move the annual meeting. And, you know, guess who won? Super Bowl won, because people were not coming. And since the Vikings were in the Super Bowl for so many times, it made it a little extra. But that aside, religion consecrates certain hours and days. There is sacred time. There is a sacred block of time lifted out of everyday normal, everyday routine. The same thing is true with sports. They're organized sports. They're scheduled. We set aside a certain time knowing that something special is going to happen at that particular time, that some great event is going to take place, something that's different. The same thing is true for the organized space that a religion has. Organized religion has certain space in which certain rituals, which we know about ahead of time, are going to take place. And we go there and we act differently in church than we do in everyday life. We stand up and sit down and do different things. Some places actually kneel, for this, which is not something ordinary, you do in ordinary life, in the office or in the classroom or whatever. Sometimes I felt the need for kneeling in prayer when I've gotten some of my blue books back, for help. But the idea is the same. It's a time that is different. Different laws apply. Ordinary time is forgotten. A time in which we set apart because we know something very special is going to take place with this. And finally, I think the final point I'd like to make, and then throw it open here really, is that religion, as I suggested before, needs a way to explain the body. Because we've got this body which is mortal, and what do we do with this sort of thing? And religion has ways in which we try to interpret the meaning of the body, not only as sort of the encasement for the soul or the spirit, whatever you want to call it, but we see it as a part of, as a part of creation. We see the body as a part of oneness, you see, with the universe, and we see it as a part of oneness with others. And professional athletes write invariably that, salary aside, the thing that makes the whole thing worthwhile for them is this sense of oneness with other people, the sense of community. Bradley celebrates this beautifully in his book on why the thing that keeps them going with all the boredom and waiting in the airports and nothing to do during the day except watch, TV game shows and all the rest, is the sense of community and participation and oneness that happens, and the feeling that when you know things are going right, when what they like to call the flow is going in the right direction, there's nothing else like it. Novak has a long section on here, which we don't have time to read, but all of which celebrates the idea of community and cooperation and sharing and working, with one another. So, to repeat here, religion then becomes the acting out of deeply felt needs that we have, and since our lives are such that oftentimes they are so structured, regulated, ruled by bureaucratic forces we don't like or other situations over which we have no control, we find the deepest needs and instincts acted out and celebrated in sports when they were done at their best. Let me read his conclusion here. Sports are not merely entertainment, but are rooted in the necessities and the aspirations of the human spirit. They should be treated with all the intelligence, care, and love the human spirit can bring to bear. It is a corruption not only of sports, but of the human spirit to treat them as an escape, as entertainment, as business, or as a means of making money. Sports do provide entertainment, but of a special and profound sort. They do depend on a financial base. And it is not wrong that they should repay investors and pay players decent returns. Yet sports are at their heart a spiritual activity, a natural religion, a tribute to grace, beauty, and excellence. We ought to keep the streams of the spirit running clean and strong.
As we think about this, I think Martin Marty said something about that half of the NFL has been born again, and Tommy Lasorda of the Dodgers talked about winning the World Series because of the great Dodger in the sky. And
there's a hymn, "Drop Kick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life."
But what do you think about the whole movement within the professional sports of A lot of the teams are having their own chaplain now. And,
I think it's a misunderstanding. If you pray to do your best, since this is your profession, if you pray to do your best, fine. But if you pray to win, I think it's wrong. I think that if you know the difference there, and I'm not one to question the sincerity of the FCA or the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. They have their annual convention for young people on our campus every summer, and it's quite an experience to see some of these tall, fantastic specimens, you know, with a basketball under one hand and a Bible in the other, you know, chugging up the hill, you know, and doing all these fantastic things together. And I think that when you ask, you know, it depends on the spirit in which it's done. I don't know if that's what you're asking.
Yes, you know, with the whole success kind of a syndrome and guys like Tommy Lasorda coming on to Dr. Schuler's television program and talking about the great Dodger in the sky, and, you know, as we identify with the professional athletes, do you think that's one reason why the born again movement is growing in our country, because of identifying with these professional athletes who are born again? Or
there's no question that
vice versa?
That's part of it. Word Books out of Waco, Texas, has they're very open about it. There's nothing subtle. They have one whole line of books in their catalog that are nothing but success stories written by famous athletes. And you too can be a Roger Staubach kind of thing. And he believes in God, and therefore you better believe in God. And the one of the objections I have against some of the Billy Graham spectacles is that he'll bring sports or beauty queen celebrities up on the stage, with the idea being that these should be significant role models. I would say if you want to bring people on the stage and let them give their testimony, fine. But bring Joe Blow or Jane Blow up on the stage, and it doesn't have to be Miss America, or it doesn't have to be Tom Landry, the coach, as I think sincere as they are with this sort of thing. And that's when it gets out of hand, because what happens there is when you put these people forward as role models, what happens to the failures? What happens to those who don't make it? What happens to those who aren't Miss America or Miss USA? And I had, as one of my majors, I had Miss USA, for instance, Barbara Peterson. And she wrote a paper about it. And what she never saw through the whole paper was what it was like to fail, because Barbara's never failed in life. And therefore, you become embittered or wonder about the efficacy of prayer, that you must have done something wrong since you prayed for God to help you, and since you didn't win, you know, therefore you let God down. But if, on the other hand, if you pray to do your best, whether that be in sports or in farming or whatever it is, you know, that's another thing altogether. That would be my answer to that. I don't know if that's helpful, but there is a very real danger in that sort of thing. And we're lucky at St. Olaf. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of him. Our baseball coach has this kind of attitude about, you know, doing your best and not praying for results that you can measure with this. And we're very lucky. He's a very popular speaker, and he goes around with this sort of message to groups like that. Yeah.
Even praying to do your best can be used wrongly, though, like the Redskins and their chaplain and so forth.
Oh, Tom Skinner?
Yeah, it seems to me that that it's using a very sacred thing, which is prayer and Christianity and so forth, in a way just to build up team spirit, and it's being used in a trivial way.
Okay.
Even though they may say the right words, we're not praying to win.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would say they're praying to win. They're praying to do their best. But I still think it's wrong.
Well, I you see, the thing I was answer to that, and I'll be glad, or do you want to, Phil?
Go ahead.
I would say, and that'll, you know, you that it's hard for us who aren't professionals to realize that that is their job. I mean, I pray to do well in my job.
But in a public sense, you put it in the paper and print it in the...
Oh, that's something else again. Yeah, I do object to the politicians having prayer breakfast. That's fine if they have prayer breakfast, but they want to be sure that the television cameras are there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong with this.
Or even the Southern football team would do it more, it seems, than the Northern football team, getting together and
Catholics cross themselves before, you know, when they come to bat. It's an honest.
It'll be a ball or a strike, you know. I mean, or am I going to get a hit? I really have some feelings about that. See,
Phil,
trivial.
Can you help me out on that?
Well, in fact, I would like to move the discussion beyond that.
Okay.
At least at some time here, I wonder if I'm the only one who felt quite uneasy about many things you said. Not in and of themselves, but where you stopped. It seems to me that you're suggesting the sports is a kind of microcosm for life that is finally spiritual. I wonder if one couldn't really analyze almost any human institution, significant human institution in that regard. But my question is whether or not that doesn't then serve as a substitute for our coming to terms with revealed religion, if you want to call it a natural religion. In fact, becomes a kind of anxious then diminishment of human transcendence. The kind of transcendence that you talked about, that we experience through spectator sports especially, is still a human one.
Yes.
Identify with a hero. And it's not the kind of transcendence that we speak of when we talk to God.
Yeah, I was going to ask if the priesthood of this religion are the professional athletes, what's the object of worship?
I mean, the object is the, how do I say it, the fulfillment of that which gives, you know, a sense of meaning and accomplishment and answers the deepest questions that you have, which are acted out in more than verbal form. I see your point, Phil.
The question is, are these adequate answers for us, or in fact are they rather diminished substitutes for that which we most deeply yearn for as a society now, particularly as the American society? This becomes a substitute for our coming to terms with God himself.
I think for many fans, you know, who are the professional fans, I think it's, there's no question that's true. I didn't put it, maybe I skipped over some limitation, some of the qualifications I put here. My point would be that we stop at a certain point because we know we don't have the clock. I didn't get into, you know, what he calls sacred time. And we always know that the clock is there and that eventually the clock is going to, you know, run out. And that therefore what we see enacted is going to stop. And that suddenly it does become something which we read about the next day in the newspaper, and we have to, you know, get up and go to our job the next, you know, the next day at that time. And if people recognize it that way, fine. But I've seen fanatic fans. I mean, this becomes, you know, that we've got one couple up there. They've got one of the, you know, you can buy an old school bus, and they painted it purple and gold, and you know, they have all the symbols of the Vikings, and they have open house, or we call it tailgating. And they follow the Vikings every game, no matter where they are. And this has become, the wife dyes her hair purple, you know, and the man has the Viking horns, and you know, the whole thing. And they can't wait. They go to training, you know, watching blocking practice. That, you know, that's a real turn on. And I agree with you, so long as you recognize it up to that point, that. The Lou Gehrig story, for instance, as a metaphor for accepting death gracefully, I think is fine. As long as you recognize that sort of thing, but when it becomes the full embodiment of one's deepest, you know, instincts for natural or for religion, then I would agree with you that it can become idolatry. You know, no question about that. But all I'm trying to suggest is that for many people, given the kind of mass society we live in today, it meets a certain kind of need which they can't find other places. And it isn't just the meanies, and it isn't just, you know, violence and brutality and all this that go along with it. But I see I can't quarrel with you.
They can't find it any other place. This is an easy means to it, especially for scholars, and that kind of spectator. Healing me to try to attempt to begin to do.
I'm unabashedly against sports because I consider them colossal waste of time. However, the reason that I do consider them a waste of time is because there's a heck of a lot he's doing in this country. And if we had half the guys that are out there running around and half the salary they get doing something that I would, that would be useful, instead of showing off playing games, which is what I call it, I think that we could get a whole lot done toward the just the pure out human thing that we need done in this country and in any country. But what bothers me is that I consider the sport in this country today as a religion, and those that worship at that altar, and they worship there, and that is their religion. And when they come out and say that they are Christian, I'm glad, because then my children can look at them and say, they are Christian. They have sports as their life for now, you know, until they get too old or whatever. And so I'm glad if they say they're Christians, because then I can say they're Christian to my children, and they are going to be their heroes anyway. Those big children, yeah. Miss America and all the others, are going to be the heroes anyway. And I think they need to say that they're Christian.
Yeah. But I would say that the need for competition is simply basic to, you know, to...
Hey, listen, I can tell you, come on down to city council.
Yeah.
County commissioners, boy, there's plenty going on.
But we need the precision and the orderliness, the defined space, the rules. That sports offer, you see. And that sports takes us out of ourselves, and the excitement about sports is that we don't know what the outcome is. We know what's going to happen at the factory tomorrow. We know what's going to happen, you know, somewhere else, wherever it might be. But we don't know what's going to happen there. And in this particular sense, it's a release, you know, from the ordinary. And that's why sports is as old as civilization itself. And when something is as old as civilization itself, it's got something going for it. And I'm as opposed to the waste of time and the corruption and the enormous salaries and the free agents and Howard Cosell as everybody else is, you know. But I do think that in the sense that Novak talks about it here, it can be interpreted in a way which gets us out of ourselves and celebrates the human spirit in a way which can be uplifting. And I would agree fully with Phil that if it stops there, then it's wrong. It's really idolatry.
How does the public know that when it stops and when it doesn't stop? You know, especially for the athletes, I worry about their spiritual life. And so therefore, I'm glad when Billy Graham brings somebody up on the stage and says, "Hey, you know, they know him, and I want them to know him."
Okay. So a hand here, that's the coffee bell, but feel free, you know. I'll be glad to go on for this for a long time because I think we're onto something here.
I guess I just was going to say that I think there's an overemphasis in schools on sports.
Yes,
and taking just those who are coordinated already and taking this little group of coordinated people and not doing anything for those who are not.
Couldn't agree more on that. I was talking here about professional sports, but in the danger in high school is that you spend all this money on five boys in short pants, you know, to the detriment of everybody else.
I just recall one coach that we had, he was just new, he came up on stage and said, when he was talking about the football players, these are the men
of
the school.
Yeah,
and
that's a different problem, but it's a very real problem, because it takes money away from, you know, basic education. Which is fundamental, and the one thing where, you know, school boards are cut with or faced with having to cut budgets now, the one thing the communities don't stand or won't stand for is a cutback, you know, in sports,
right.
Because it's sports are for the parents, the little league, you know, pusher parents. They're one
but
of
there
their
is a value in a school to having that kind of institution going on in terms of school spirit, community together.
Yeah,
okay, but this is off. I'm just thinking of in junior high, and we had a son in eighth grade. There were seven boys out for basketball. He was coordinated too, but for most of the time, five of those boys played and two sat on the bench, even when we were 21 points ahead.
That's the way life is, though.
No, I
don't think it's right.
No, I don't either, but that's what your life is. You're right. You know, I don't know what you can do about it.
You look like you're ready to burst forth.
No, it doesn't look like I'm ready.
questions. I wonder, maybe I was hoping we could avoid this topic in the forum on Thursday when we talked.
Oh, in the high school. Okay, we can save that
maybe
for the.
We should have the forum.
Well, there's lots of things in the high schools we can talk about.
But yes, this abuse, of course, in the public school system is, in a sense, partly a consequence of the religious cult of professional sports. They have to insist upon that because sports is so much, so central to their lives.
And they see it there, and they want it. Yeah, no, they see it on television, and they want their boys to be little Jack Nicklauses or Fran Tarkentons, and I think that's true. Chevy?
Who is to decide, and how is it to be decided?
We are.
No, I mean, each person has to. I mean, you...
Anything. Any question. Or are we not to ask questions?
Well, the free market. You're an economist. You know, you take something out, you put a product on the market, and you see what happens to it. And what's happened has been phenomenal success with a product. What is it? $250,000 a minute for a TV commercial for the Super Bowl? No, that's what's happened. It's a, you know, and
who decided that?
The public.
Is that wrong?
It can be, you know, it can be.
Give me the rules.
No, there are no fixed rules in a free economy. You know, what we would
call
a free
economy. There are no rules for right and wrong.
No, but people have the right to make mistakes, you know.
What is for advertisement? When it, you know, when it's anything else but a game, then we go, you know, way off the deep end.
I think there's some good things about competitive sports.
There's great competition in sports, but then whenever you're more concerned with the selling of a product, which means you have a large following, and it's not something that you participate in as a player, but where it's more important that you gather a whole bunch of people to support the priesthood, if you will.
Yeah.
Then you're in big trouble. W.H. Auden has a great essay on games, and, you know, talks about it's precisely in sport, in games, that you have to abide by the rules, and no one will tolerate it. But look what's happening in professional sports today. Everybody is attempting to cut the rules.
Games are all right as long as people don't come to see them? How do you mean that?
I think that it's better for myself. I would much rather play a sandlot baseball game than go see a baseball game. And almost any kind of sport you mention, if it's worth watching, it's better to play it.
I like to see Rod Carew play, and we can't see him play unless there is somebody to pay his.
That's not my idolatry, I guess. I have other ones.
Well,
there's an excellent
there.
If
the idea there is to see, you know, to see somebody who is in complete control and can do it, you know, in a way that...
You're watching excellence.
Right? You're watching excellence, right.
The same thing would be true if you're watching the ballet.
A ballet, right.
That's right. That's
yeah.
We haven't talked at all about violence in sports. I lived in Canada for the last 3 years, where it's not baseball so much, but I saw it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that draws sighs and tears from the crowd is not so much a perfectly executed goal, but you know, people battling each other with their sticks. And
right.
The more hits over the head, the more sighs and tears from the crowd.
Yeah.
And we haven't explored this side of the other side.
I'm looking like crazy here for what he says about violence.
Well, you're looking early. Sure. My wheel is sitting here wondering if maybe on Thursday night, as long as we've gotten to our discussion going here, if we should turn to that issue of sports in particular, not necessarily limited to schools, but maybe early including some discussion on that. The other topic is one that's, you know, maybe of less immediate excitement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds good.
The short story Rollerball, and they made a movie
out of it. Rollerball,
yeah. The short story Rollerball is the most frightening thing that I've read in ages, and that's all about that violence that is, you participate in the violence vicariously by watching a killing.
Oh, yeah, there's no question there. Who is it, this guy, Dave Schultz for the Philadelphia... whatever their hockey team is. Yeah, the Schultz's army, and they sit wearing German spiked helmets, you know, in the old army. You know, kill, maim, destroy. That goes with this. And what what Novak is arguing for, obviously, is it's a sermon, you know, to get away from this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And
I mean, the analysis is one thing, but doing something, yeah. But doing something with the analysis is quite
another thing. Yeah, we faced, you know, a situation in Minnesota where Dave Forbes from the Bruins was arrested because he used his hockey stick to blind you know, Henry Boucher, and was arrested for it, but was acquitted because the argument was that that's the chance you take in sports, and if you go out on the field, you know, you have to accept it, which doesn't do much for Henry's career, you know, with this. But I agree with the violent thing. I don't think that Gene Bianchi, who writes a lot in religious subjects, argued that we got into Watergate, I mean, we got into Vietnam because we had become so inured to violence in this country that we didn't see or recognize or condone the violence, you know, that was going on, because sports had been violent. They were much more violent in the 1890s than they are now with this sort of thing. But the violent thing is very real.